Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me is a guy who you always want by your side when the markets are rocky. Steve, how you doing?
I will comfort you back to life, John. Good to be here. How are you?
A shoulder to cry on. Yeah. Might not help you pick the, you know, figure out what to do, but, you know, he'll sympathize.
Yeah, exactly. We can commiserate together, you and I, and anyone else. Call me up.
You know what? This year, people do need a lot of sympathy if they've been, if they were looking to spend any of that crypto this year.
That's right.
HODL. That's what
HODL
I say.
All the way. Yeah.
Well, hopefully you're not day trading and losing your shirt. You have a little bit of a longer horizon. But here to help us and that knows a little bit more about the crypto markets and risk management and how to not lose your shirt, hopefully, is Sameer Ghosh, the head of product at Falcon X. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, John and Steve, for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Really interesting time for you guys. Just since you're in the investment and crypto spaces, especially with all the development going on, I see so many articles about institutional investments, JP Morgan, Fidelity, big players still rolling out new investment options in the blockchain-related space. How do you see things these days?
It's a great question, John. And I second sort of the perspective you mentioned at the beginning. There's no question about it. Risk on assets have sold off in this environment. It's driven by inflation, rising interest rates, and I think most forecasts expect the trend to continue. That said, at Falcon X, over the course of the past year, every single quarter, we have seen some of the largest players in asset management onboarding to our brokerage. We've had the highest number of institutions onboarding every single quarter for the past four quarters. And so I think that if you look at investors with a long-term view of the space, there's still that interest. And we still see those players coming in. But without a doubt, in this market environment, the what it takes in order to be able to generate returns and alpha in a scalable way has materially changed. And it's one reason why I'm excited about Falcon X 360 and the new product that we've brought to market.
Yeah, what is Falcon X 360?
Sure. Well, I think a good place
I'm
to start.
I'm glad you asked. I'm going to slow pitch him to you today, Sameer.
Yeah, thanks so much for the softball, John. I think in describing any product, we like to build products with our customers and just really trying to deeply understand the problems that they're encountering. And for years, what institutions were telling us was that there was a multitude of problems that they faced when they started to enter digital asset space. And so, just to take a name or start this with an example, if you're managing, let's say you have $1 billion of assets under management, being able to actually access liquidity at scale starts to matter. So if you're getting a price difference of 5 basis points, 10 basis points on your trades, the actual costs of that start to grow very, very, very fast as you start to trade in greater sizes and volumes. And so we were having institutions that were entering the space sort of asking, well, it's really hard to know where to start. You know, should I open an account at Coinbase? Should I open an account with another exchange? Should I look to some of the market makers in this space that are providing liquidity off exchanges? And they were having a lot of trouble navigating this problem. And the reason for that is in other asset classes, you don't have the same problem of liquidity fragmentation. If you want to trade Apple stock, you go to New York Stock Exchange. In crypto, if you want to trade Bitcoin, one of the beauties of decentralization is anyone, anywhere on the planet can launch an exchange, can launch a liquidity pool. But it becomes a lot more difficult if you're trying to transact at size because you need to now stitch together a lot of different exchanges in order to get your execution done. So that was the first problem that we wanted to help institutions solve, which was answering that question of how can I access liquidity in digital assets significantly more efficiently than trying to piece together this fragmented ecosystem myself. The second problem that we identified was, in this market environment, we saw over the course of the past two quarters, the biggest deleveraging and de-risking of this asset class in its entire history with over $2 billion of losses with the collapse of Three Arrows Capital and Luna. Mm-hmm.
$2 trillion?
Billion.
Oh, billion. Okay.
Yeah. $2 billion. And, you know, even to date, we've been seeing some of the repercussions of that, you know, with losses for many of the lenders in the space in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And with a lot of players in the space filing for bankruptcy or forced acquisitions, you know, this is the type of systemic risk that you start to, that really keeps you up at night if you're an institutional asset manager. What are my exposures? You know, how can I make sure that I'm on top of managing all those exposures and all the effects of, you know, dominoes as they start to fall?
So in many ways, it seems like you're catering to a segment of the market that's actually more bullish, I would say, on crypto than the consumer space, right? We've seen how that's how, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of institutional investment still in crypto, even after the so-called crypto winter, right? What do you think about the possibilities of crypto investments? What is it about it that makes it so attractive to investors? And why hasn't that been reflected on the consumer side? Like, why have we seen declining trading numbers, say, on Coinbase and Kraken and all that stuff as well? But it seems like there's still institutional money coming into the other side. What's sort of the driving factor to make a difference there?
What's fundamentally changed about the market in the past 12 to 24 months is what it takes to generate returns has actually, the bar's gotten higher in these market environments. What I mean by that is, you know, a great strategy 2-3 years ago would have been, you know, buy Bitcoin and hold, or buy Ethereum and hold over the course of, you know, 12, 24 months. And that still may be a great strategy for a long time horizon. But for institutional investors that are looking to generate risk-adjusted returns and control for downturns like this, it takes more than just access to spot markets to generate great returns that, you know, your LPs are paying you for. Specifically, over the course of the past 12 months, we've seen a huge rise in demand in clients that are trading market-neutral strategies. Now, what does that mean, running a market-neutral strategy? It means a lot of institutions are buying spot, maybe buying Bitcoin or Ethereum, and then hedging their risk with derivatives. These are futures contracts or swap contracts in order to be able to, you know, manage their risk. So if the market moves up, they're hedged. If the market moves down, they're also hedged. And these strategies that seek arbitrage and alpha in the market through price discrepancies are what we see growing fastest. Now, in order to execute that, it takes a lot more tools. It takes a lot more sophistication from a risk management perspective. And today, FalconX 360 is the only place on the planet where institutions can get access to 94% of global spot and derivatives liquidity in one place. The only place where they can then stake those assets and borrow against the netted risk in their whole portfolio. What that means is if you're trading these strategies, the returns might be 5-6%, not the same as what they once were. But since you can manage your whole portfolio in one place, we give institutions the ability to get leverage across all of that. All those balances and positions, and turn 5-6% returns into something greater.
So a bit of a philosophical question then on this. It seems like there's a lot of structural things that make this a much more attractive proposition for, again, institutions, but not so much the consumer side. And I recall that one of the big selling points of crypto was that this was going to democratize, you know, and decentralize finance. What do you think that means for sort of the cryptocurrency space after we come out of the winter, right? If you see all the institutions sort of running away with all the alpha and being able to basically generate returns for their LPs, as you say, but then on the consumer side, you see sort of the opposite of that.
You know, I think it's a really, really important dilemma for the space to sort out. At its core, I think that there's a lot of value in being able in building these bridges for institutional capital to come in. What I mean by that specifically is, as capital comes into the space, whether it's through market neutral strategies or other forms of strategies, what ends up happening is the protocols themselves grow in market capitalization and can disseminate more value to their users. A great example of this, and one of the examples that I think is uniquely made possible by crypto and has the potential to benefit consumers pretty massively, is the credit space. Today, anyone anywhere on the planet with access to digital can access digital assets and can access the ability to borrow against, you know, their portfolio through decentralized lending protocols such as Compound. In a world where a lot of our financial infrastructure and is moving to applications, in a world, for example, like India, where I worked for a number of years, where the majority of consumers have the majority of their financial lives on their mobile phones, right? What that means is, right, if I have digital assets in my portfolio, I can actually borrow against that and utilize that capital today without any massive costs of financial intermediation. And so I think what you need is institutional capital to come into the space, disseminate value to projects so that they can invest in the ecosystem and communities that help build value and applications for the end consumers. And that's the virtuous cycle that we're creating. And that's sort of how I see the flow of capital and the flow of value playing out in the space.
Well, you're operating in the US, right? So I guess a couple of things with that, but what are the regulatory limitations around that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Regulation is actually incredibly important in our view for the space. Specifically, what I mean by that is, if you look again at the past couple quarters, what you saw was, in short, poor risk management practices for lenders that were overextending themselves and providing lending services and taking in collateral that was fundamentally illiquid. We need more regulatory oversight in order to create a system that is more sturdy and durable in any sort of market conditions. And so FalconX as a firm is pretty proactive in working with regulators. And in particular, what it means for our products and services is that we seek a way of working with regulators in order to provide access to them. By way of example, today as a firm, we are the first and only actually CFTC registered swaps dealer on the planet, which means that for someone, an institution, let's say, you know, a major bank or a major hedge fund that's looking to access derivatives products, they can actually do that through a regulated vehicle at FalconX. And so we think that working with regulators can help fuel the fire of adoption much more quickly than continuing to innovate outside of regulatory bounds. And so for our customers in particular, it's an imperative for doing business with anyone. For the industry more broadly, I think that there is a balancing act between innovation and regulation. And so when you're on the cutting edge, right, when you're developing a new protocol and you're at the frontier of technology, right, you want to be aware of the bounds of regulation. You want to be also innovating and working with regulators to ensure that you can have that capacity. Our customers are unlikely to be the earliest of adopters of the newest, most cutting edge technologies. And so we're sort of paving the way for a lot of those players to come into the space and adopt these technologies by working with regulators. And it's something that for us has been really exciting. A lot of the regulators are looking at this space with relatively sort of open eyes, open arms. We hope that that dialogue can continue.
So on the lobbying side, I know that I read somewhere that crypto lobbying has actually quadrupled since 2018, but I'm wondering what specific rules and regulations do you want to see in the crypto space? And I should also note that the funding comes from, right? It's not just Coinbase and Ripple. It comes from even Facebook, right? With their Calibre project. It comes from IBM, which also has a stake in building blockchain products. But I'm not sure what the unified sort of call is to have everyone again, quadruple their lobbying funds in 4 years. So what do you want from the regulators? What do you want from a policy perspective?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think the first thing that I'll call out about working with regulators is that it really has to be, a dialogue. And without that dialogue, it's very, very hard to create innovations that can add value to society, but also be safe for society to interact with. And so we see a lot of these debates on, I think recently we saw a lot of this on Twitter with SBF and the community sort of going a little bit, and Eric Voorhees going back and forth a little bit in terms of what the best way to interact with regulators is. We're of the perspective that it's important to have ongoing dialogues so that the regulators are educated about the space that they're looking at. And it's an imperative that the regulators will act in some way, shape, or form. So the best we can do is provide the information, provide the education and context so that we can make the best or help make the best informed decisions. Some spaces where I think the space might benefit most from regulation is, or the biggest theme is clarity. By way of example, today staking is a product and service offered by many, but it's unclear sort of which regulatory jurisdiction that, if it's offered at scale, will sit underneath and within. It's likely to be the case when you have any innovation in terms of what's possible. But an ongoing dialogue to help define where different regulatory bodies will have oversight, to help define sort of the rules of engagement, will really, I think, help catalyze and expedite the pace of innovation, the pace of providing value.
Yeah, there's definitely not a complete clarity in a lot of areas, which makes it kind of risky. I'm thinking, there's a few things, but I'm thinking of is XRP a security? Or now that Ethereum is proof of stake, I've seen in the news some regulators saying, well, now it's meets the Howey test of which is some standard questions or that have been used for a long time, whether determining if something is a security that needs to be regulated. I imagine that that keeps your compliance and risk management people pretty busy.
Yes, and definitely, we've got a very busy and active compliance legal team interacting with a variety of law firms and representatives as well in DC and Singapore to understand their approach to regulation. And things like the Howey test are very, very, very helpful guiding principles. The Howey test is a breakdown of sort of what an investment contract is, and then how he tests as if it meets, if an investment meets four criteria, then it qualifies as a security. It needs to be an investment of money in a common enterprise with the expectation of profits, and those profits would be derived from others. So those are the four, I think, underpinning principles of the Howey test and in determining whether or not an asset is a security or not. I don't have a strong stance. I'll leave that up to the regulators and compliance team to determine, which particular assets should or should not be considered securities under the test. And that said, frameworks like this are incredibly helpful and incredibly powerful when making business decisions about, how to innovate and how to build. And so we really welcome them. And so do our clients. They're not only asking us for what we're hearing from regulators, but they're also very actively engaged in dialogues, and so it's definitely been very, very helpful to have sort of principles like that in and frameworks like that in determining how we conduct business.
It's almost like who's on third, who's actually going to regulate me.
It's hard to tell where it's really going to land. There's so many issues around the risk management as well. You mentioned the wide coverage of different cryptocurrencies that you guys work with and support for your institutional investors. On some of the smaller market caps, how do you do risk management? Well, even some of the larger ones, how do you do risk management when a lot of the trading is international? It's way outside of what's going on in the US. And there's been a history of things like wash sales, market manipulation, fake trades to make volumes and prices pumped up. I mean, we certainly saw that with NFTs. So how do you, I mean, you just present it or your customers just accept that there's going to be that risk associated and you just support that, their activity or something else?
Yeah, it's actually a very insightful question. There's multiple layers of risk when you are interacting with digital assets. And the first problem, as you called out, John, is the first problem is if I try to buy this asset, is the price that I see the price that I'm going to get? Or is it going to move a huge amount on me? And that was actually the first problem that Falcon X as a firm looked into and built technology to resolve in the first 2 to 3 years of building out the firm. And what we did was we actually looked at and built machine learning models. These are actually deep learning models. Our head of engineering was one of the founding engineers at TensorFlow at Google. And so, you know, he said, let's use these frameworks. Let's take a look at execution in digital assets, because we know that a huge amount of the volume being printed on exchanges, a huge amount of the volume being or liquidity being provided by market makers is what we consider to be somewhat false, which meant, you know, if you show a price for, let's say $1 million worth of Bitcoin, maybe the first $10,000, you know, you'll sell it to me for $20,000 per BTC. But the next $10,000, you're going to move the price and raise it a little bit, and you're going to keep doing that. So the liquidity is actually that you're showing me is not real. And this is a big problem on exchanges and a big problem if you're looking to transact in size. And so what we built out was we looked at essentially years of execution data, years of liquidity data, and built out machine learning models that could help filter out all of that fake liquidity in the ecosystem. And what we do for our clients is we show them a price that has filtered out that liquidity and is fundamentally fillable in real time. So the likelihood that your price actually moves for a large transaction is significantly lower. So investors can transact with the confidence that what they're seeing is what they'll get. And in an unregulated market where there's no regulation in terms of what the best bid and offer is, that's something MBBO is something that exists in equities and where brokers have a mandate, you know, to at least execute at that level. So in a unregulated global market or less regulated global market, building out technology solutions to help provide the same level of certainty is sort of the approach that we took. And so we built out machine learning models to provide fundamentally fillable prices, filter out fake liquidity, wash volume. And that was the first product we brought to market.
So I can buy Dogecoin safely now.
Yeah, that's right.
Not that you should.
Not that you
should. Shiba Inu, those are real prices now.
And yeah, exactly. And to your point, the further down the stack you move, the bigger the problem gets.
Yeah, it's easy to manipulate this smaller caps.
It absolutely is. And I'd say the surface area of the problem, what we've seen in terms of markets and liquidity is it's actually reduced a bit. Exchanges have gotten more stringent about the way in which they report volume, the requirements they have for liquidity providers in holding.
And some of the exchanges kind of want to show that there's a lot of volume. I mean, it's not just the, it might be even worse than actually the cryptocurrency, but the exchange wants to show that they're viable, that they have a lot of business going on their platforms.
Oh, definitely. It's a marketing stat, because if you're new to the space and you're trying to decide where to go, the first thing that you'll type into Google is biggest exchange, you know, and you'll end up on CoinMarketCap or CoinGecko, And there they have published the quote unquote volume statistics. FTX is a really interesting volume monitor where they too invested in an initiative to filter out what they consider to be fake volume. They reach similar conclusions. If you look at that database, it's 60 to 70% of what's reported is actually not there. It's actually not billable liquidity. And so this is a big problem. I mean, and as you move down market in terms of the tokens, the problem gets even bigger. And if you transact in bigger sizes, the problem gets that much bigger. And so a really important problem, the first one that we solved, and it's only the beginning of some of the challenges in execution risk management that are posed when you're starting to build positions and manage a portfolio in the space. The second thing, right, that you need to look into is, right now that we have, and this was the problem that actually was not correctly assessed and led to a lot of the liquidity and leverage crisis and the massive losses in Q2 and Q3. The second problem is, okay, now we have clients with portfolios of, Dogecoin, Bitcoin, and Samir Coin, let's say. And
I wouldn't buy that one.
Yeah, definitely stay away. And so my portfolio is all these different assets. And what lenders were doing in the space was they were all giving them the same value. Now, what we do at FalconX is we say, well, we know that if we try to sell $1 million worth of Samir Coin, it's going to move the market a heck of a lot because the liquidity, there's not many buyers, John, to your point, of Samir Coin or name that shit coin. And so I'm going to discount that a lot because it's an illiquid token. But we saw a lot of lenders taking things that were fundamentally illiquid and not appropriately discounting them. And so the core work that we did at the beginning of the firm to understand liquidity, to understand what's fillable, actually is enabling infrastructure to make us better risk managers and better stewards of this ecosystem by understanding the liquidity, by understanding the risk of holding any of these assets, by understanding how to discount them. You can become much better primes in the space. And it's something, and it's some data that we've really used in the platform. We make it all available to our users, the discount factors. And we think that it helps create a more secure, stable operating environment for everyone in the space.
Yeah, I've seen that where just because the first Samir coin sold for $10,000, the second, third, and fourth transactions have huge price impacts. And
yes,
and probably right. Discounts on that. So you can't multiply that one trade times the whole issuance. It's just not going to play out that way.
Yeah, but,
absolutely. Yeah, it sounds like your risk management people are in a really interesting place. You've got to be on their toes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it all starts with data and understanding it well, being able to model it well so that you can provide best in class value to your clients. The other piece of what we are have unique sort of access to is we do billions of dollars of volume every single day.
So Samir, I'm sure a lot of people would want to know, how did you land this role at FalconX? You're head of product there. It looks like you've a very interesting background, but tell us a little bit about that and how this came about.
Yeah, it's been an interesting journey, John. And thanks for asking. For me, my core, I've always been an entrepreneur. I've been a founder and someone that's joined early stage tech ventures. Generally speaking, in product roles and marketplace kind of technologies. And before FalconX, I had been on the startup journey, 0 to 1 and 1 to 10. I had an acquisition just before FalconX, and I was in what the engineering team here at FalconX calls the dark side. I was at business school.
The dark side?
Yes, that's what business school is referred to by the engineering.
Oh, the business school. Okay, got it.
Yeah,
that makes more sense now.
So while I was at the dark side, I was falling down the now proverbial crypto rabbit hole. I started to trade a lot. And while I was doing that, I noticed some big gaps in terms of the infrastructure that was available to me. I also really, really, really fell in love with the first principles of crypto, right? This permissionless innovation, right? The ability for protocols and application and decentralized applications to interact in a modular way and this fungibility. I thought these were very interesting ideas, but I also knew that it was going to be very, very difficult for there to be any adoption if real capital can't come into the space, because what we're building at that point in time was the entire financial services stack from the ground up. So I started talking to a lot of players in the space. I got connected with the founders here at Falcon X, and I was compelled to join. And on day one, I was the sixth team member to join here. I realized I didn't know what the company did. And that's when I knew I made a great decision. It's kind of backwards. Awesome. I knew I made a great decision because the founders were that, they had that level of magnetism, and they were able to attract a great team. When you have really great people you can work with and you can learn a lot, the rest is easy. And so I think what's really interesting about product management in crypto is the pace of learning and the pace of innovation is fundamentally on a different level than any other industry.
So basically, be curious, be smart, be capable, have great experience, and be very good looking, and you'll do fine.
And in the case of Samir, also have amazing hair.
Yeah, that last one I practiced the most, I guess.
That takes work. That doesn't happen by accident.
No.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, it's been a really, really fun journey. That much is true. And I think the amount of ownership that you're asked to have and the pace that you're asked to learn in this space to really do an amazing job is just such a privilege to have. And so it's been an amazing journey the past 4 years. And I'm excited for the next 4 years of innovation and rebuilding the financial services stack.
Yeah. We have just no ambition there at all. Just rebuild all of finance. No problem.
Easy peasy.
Well, yeah, good luck with that. And thanks for joining us on the podcast. Really interesting to have you on.
John and Steve, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, that's Samir Ghosh, the head of product at Falcon X. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.